thank you so much again for agreeing to come and talk to us. I've been wanting to for a really long time, but I know you're very busy, so thanks for giving us the time. How's everything going today? How are you feeling? How's everything going?
Yeah, things are good. I know we've been trying to schedule this for a while, and it was the bribe that you finally offered that was the difference when we finally agreed to do it. But I'm excited beyond the money to talk to you. Yeah, things are great. I actually just got back from a vacation with my kids yesterday, and there's a lot of news, including the Amber Heard and Johnny Depp verdict, which it seems, if you look at it from one perspective, is kind of like a trivial celebrity trial. But actually, I found it super illuminating about a lot of substantive life issues and cultural and political issues as well. So I've been following it very closely, which is the only way I would talk about that. And also the verdict in the Hillary Clinton case, where the evidence was more important than the verdict, and lots of changes on Ukraine that I'm following. So I've only been home about 24 hours, and I feel like things are swirling already.
Bombarded.
Feels same. Like every day is like that
same.
These days. Though,
every
right?
time I like open Twitter, I feel like I have like dementia. It's like so difficult to decode everything that's going on. But you were just speaking about the Amber Heard and Johnny Depp case, which I've also been following for similar reasons. And there's been this whole thing that's been going around of people saying that Johnny Depp has ruined the legacy of Me Too, or that this case is like sort of an undoing of the legacy of Me Too. There seems to be this like weird anxiety like among liberals. Is this something that you've noticed as well?
I think the legacy of Me Too was already eroding prior to this trial, or at the very least, it was recalibrating. I had occasion to go and look back at a couple of the early Me Too cases where, in that climate when it first began, people were petrified to stand up and question any of it. It's often the way these things happen when, you know, immediately after the George Floyd killing or the January 6th, riot or the Russian invasion of Ukraine, things get very kind of rigid and people are petrified to dissent in any way from this onslaught of consensus. And that very much happened in the emergence of Me Too, where all kinds of people's careers and reputations were destroyed evidently permanently based on what I think even now, a couple of years later, we would regard as woefully inadequate to assume the person did anything wrong, let alone immediately conflate them with Harvey Weinstein. So there was a lot of conflation. The minute somebody got accused of being a little bit creepy on a date, they got turned into a serial rapist. Oftentimes, there was just no evidence presented of any kind to suggest that the accusations were true, trivial as they that were. And the idea was believe women, and anyone who didn't was almost under suspicion for themselves being a culprit, and people were petrified to stand up for anybody. And I think what we're seeing now is the kind of culmination of this recalibration where, you know, there's no group of people by virtue of their demographic characteristics who deserve to be presumptively believed without any evidence, without any proof, because that's a power that all human beings will end up abusing. And I think you can look at this as kind of a punctuation point on that.
That's perfectly summed up. And I think that's where a lot of the anxiety around how this will impact Me Too is coming from. It's sort of created this enclave where people can launder careerist and like antisocial impulses with very little kind of social consequence. And now that there's been a hole punctured in that moral cover, there's sort of this panic going on, especially because it's been so public. And I, at first I was quite critical about Johnny Depp being so public about this whole thing, but now I kind of get that he really kind of needed to be in order to clear his name publicly, and because of the significance this has, not just for him, but for anyone else who could fall prey to similar, some similar issues. And yeah, so many people have, and I mean, yeah, like you're saying, things are getting spinning out of control. Things are getting more censorious. People are being maligned more for minor infractions. Every day this week as well, Joe Rogan has been trending, which is another thing that I've noticed. But when you click on it, it doesn't actually say anything. It's just a bunch of like vague statements about his morality and his character, which has been really disturbing to witness as well. The comedian is what the comedian Bo Burnham, almost as if he was like weaponized like by some DNC operative, did a weird parody of Joe Rogan, basically making fun of him, and they've been retweeting that all week. It's really bizarre. And I guess my question to you, since this is stuff that you've been following for a really long time, where do you think this is all headed? Is it really a zero-sum game? Because it seems that way when you talk to people on every side of the political spectrum. There's this idea that there's no way we can find any kind of nuance or understanding. One, somebody has to lose, somebody has to go down, there has to be some kind of reckoning, whether those fantasies are projected around elections or other things. Where do you think this is heading, and do you think there's any sort of solution to this issue?
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, on the issue of the trial, the Johnny Depp trial, you know, interestingly, my trajectory was similar to yours. I had never really paid very close attention to these allegations back and forth, precisely because they seemed more like celebrity tabloid fodder than anything meaningful. And when I started watching the trial, all I really knew was that a British judge had rather decisively ruled in essentially against Johnny Depp, ruling in favor of the newspaper he sued, and concluding there was ample evidence to substantiate the allegation that he had engaged in physical abuse of his then-wife, Amber Heard. And I think I began watching the trial presuming that he was sort of suing because he's been in this entitlement bubble for so long, where he's constantly been told that he's correct and that he's right and that he's always blameless. That's the sort of thing fame and wealth permits. And that's part of what began interesting me about the trial, was kind of getting a glimpse into this world and seeing the divergence between what society tells you you should want in order to make you happy and the reality of what actually makes you happy. Because if there's one thing everybody could agree on, having heard that trial, the two people involved, despite having all the fame and wealth and beauty and, you know, opportunities in the world, were anything but happy. They were the exact opposite of happy. And, you know, I think there's some interesting lessons there. And I kind of got sucked into watching it in part because of that, because I also like trials from my former life as a lawyer. But, you know, my when you start paying attention to the actual kind of first order facts, like the actual documents and the facts, and not having it mediated through other people, you so often see how easy it is to be misled if you're just relying upon narratives concocted by others. And the difference when you start looking yourself and what it is that you learn, and it completely changed my mind about what actually happened there. And on your question about, you know, are we so polarized that there's no nuance permitted? I actually think there's kind of two conversations going on, and I think it's important to remember that. And Joe Rogan is probably the most illustrative example of this, where you kind of have what I would call, for lack of a better term at the moment, Twitter discourse, in which members of the left-wing media and the right-wing media kind of go to war every day in sort of a gladiator-type coliseum for the profit of billionaires, you know?
Yeah.
The nature of that forum is designed to foster nothing but conflict. Conflict is where the profit comes from, through for engagement and through excitement, and that is designed to kind of encourage people to show their worst selves. And I think that there's something about left-wing politics as well, that instead of doing what most political movements should do, and I think generally do, which is look for ways to convert people, to expand the number of people who are adherents to their cause, they instead look for ways to minimize their tribe, to almost make it like it's some sort of an exclusive club. You know, like you want your club to be exclusive because then you feel valuable because you belong. And, you know, they've turned people like Joe Rogan, who 18 months ago said that his favorite presidential candidate was Bernie Sanders, the only left-wing socialist candidate who was a viable presidential candidate in the United States in decades, into some kind of like far-right fascist.
Oh, yeah.
The same thing they've done with other people like, you know, Russell Brand and I guess myself. Like,
yeah, you.
Yeah, you know, this long list of bizarre far-right extremists who the minute you kind of dispute or dissent from or diverge from left-wing orthodoxy, they want to declare you their enemy and push you away and insist that you're in the other camp, even if you say you're not, which is a bizarre way to do politics, to kind of look for heretics to kick out of your club. But I think there's a lot of that going on. And Joe Rogan is, because he doesn't belong to any one tribe and can't be controlled, they kind of can't stand it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Definitely. And that was sort of my theory when I first saw how serious the attacks against him got, to the point where Jen Psaki, representing the White House in its official capacity, basically called for Spotify to censor him during the COVID situation. When it got that serious, was when my heckles kind of peaked up, because it went beyond, like you said, the gladiator discourse, sort of into the halls of power. And one of the things that you talk about pretty well, and that you've really sort of articulated better than most, is the sort of pull, the push towards a more censorious climate in during this period. You talk about things like the Biden administration's domestic war on terror, the different ways that consent is being manufactured to limit the amount that we're allowed to speak, to limit the scope of the media landscape, all of those different things. And you see people on the left sort of cheering this stuff on constantly. All the things that they would be traditionally against are now things that if you dissent against, you get lumped into the basket of deplorables, which is constantly expanding to include basically everyone. Again, you say there's two separate conversations going on in terms of what's going on Twitter and what's going on in the real world. But I kind of see Twitter bleeding into the real world a lot more nowadays. I feel like it's becoming ubiquitous and normalized, the mentality, the sort of infantile splitting. And it is very difficult for people like yourself and Joe Rogan and others to exist in a media climate when everything sort of incentivizes division. How do you navigate that? What's your method of sort of dealing with this sort of climate?
I think, you know, one of the things that is important to realize, and I the reason I emphasize Twitter is kind of its own separate world, was not to say it doesn't wield influence, because I agree with you, it does. When mm-hmm. one place is the venue for political and media elites to gather and to disseminate information and to receive information and to participate mm-hmm. in the discourse, of course that place is going to be influential beyond just, you know, it's not like Twitter is just some isolated fantasy world that doesn't exist in the real world or have any effects on it. Of course it does. And interestingly, one of the things that I think people haven't fully internalized is how international that effect is. You know, if you mm-hmm. Look at the discourse in other countries, you can see the effects of American Twitter kind of spreading out to these other countries. I mean, Brazilian politics, you know, I live in Brazil for 17 years now, Brazilian politics and the discourse of the Brazilian left used to be very, very different in terms of its emphasis, in terms of the way that it spoke about things. And, you know, I started noticing, I guess, around last year when the Brazilian left and the Brazilian media became obsessed with the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, which makes no sense. Why would Brazilians, with all of their own problems with race and, you know, inequality and a justice system and crime, be so obsessed with this relatively insignificant trial taking place in Wisconsin? And yet they were obsessed. They had very strong opinions about it. And interestingly, they knew almost nothing about it. So by the, you know, even a year and a half after it happened, like the week that the verdict was being delivered, three major Brazilian newspapers who were purporting to tell readers what happened all said, you know, basically like 2 days before the verdict was issued, that Kyle Rittenhouse shot three black men. And of course, in reality, he shot no black men.
Yeah.
He shot all white men.
Yeah.
And the only way that you would simultaneously be talking so much and purporting to publish a news article about a trial, even though you obviously know nothing about it, because if you think he shot three black men, you haven't obviously watched a single second of the trial or paid much attention, is because you're seeing on your social media feed the kind of American journalist and political activist that you follow talking about it all the time, so you feel like you should.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of this, you know, in terms of Ukraine, you see it very visibly. I mean, in 2002, 2003, there was enormous dissent when it came to Iraq. Germany and France in particular were unified against the idea of going to war in Iraq and thought the United States and the UK had gone off the deep end. And I really wonder now, you see this kind of unity in the West when it comes to Ukraine, very little dissent, about whether that would have happened if social media had existed in 2002 and 2003 and everybody was much more connected across borders. So I think the problem is Twitter is spilling over, not just into the real world in the United States or domestically, but internationally as well. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, when you look at people like Joe Rogan, and, you know, I knew I had to talk about the acquittal of Hillary's lawyer, which I mentioned at the top, and now the Johnny Depp trial, and also even some things with Ukraine, I purposely stayed away from Twitter when talking about it because I know there's no way to do that fruitfully because of all the attributes of Twitter that you just outlined. And so instead, I now have venues where I can go do that instead, on Substack, on Rumble, on Call-In, where you can speak in a more substantive way. You're less, you know, kind of coerced by tribal pressures. And that part of the media that proclaims no connection to any ideology or party is the part of the media that's thriving and growing so rapidly, which is what explains the fear of Joe Rogan. The reason it got all the way up to the White House is because they know he exercises enormous influence. He speaks to millions of people than the cable hosts combined. And unlike the cable hosts, who they can mostly control or at least put in a bipartisan box, Joe Rogan, they can't. And that's what fears them. And the thing that makes me optimistic is that that part of the media that happens off Twitter, that is independent of these kind of, you know, liberal and political elites, that's the part that's growing as their part of the media ecosystem collapses.
Yeah, I mean, you said Twitter's getting, obviously, becoming more and more important in terms of international issues and stuff. Do you feel like Elon's plan is going to save it? Do you feel like there's anything that can save it? Is alt tech actually kind of your, suggested solution to the whole how bad Twitter is thing?
Not just Twitter, but social media in general, I guess, because it's kind of a thing everywhere.
I know I found the episode of the reaction to Elon's announcement that he intended to purchase Twitter and to restore at least a modicum of free speech to one of the crevices of the internet where it used to exist but no longer does, to be so revealing. Whether or not he goes through with this purchase, whether he's true to his intentions to actually restore free speech, whether he even has thought very deeply about what that means or cares about it are all things I question. But even if it does happen, and even if he is true to his words, I always knew that the real question was not what are his motives, but what are his abilities, because you see how crucial it is for power centers to wield their most potent weapon, which right now is the ability to control the flow of information over the internet. That's what this whole controversy of appointing a DHS czar to decree disinformation was all about. Yep. That's why there was so much panic when Elon said he wanted to bring some free speech to Twitter, because in a way, the only real weapon that the ruling class elite have in their arsenal at the moment is this ongoing censorship regime that they have constructed and that's actually growing as a result of a union between corporate and state power, which is kind of one of the hallmarks of fascism, at least in the academic sense of that term. And liberals seem very on board with that. So I found in the reaction to both Joe Rogan, who they couldn't control, and then the prospect that Elon was going to take Twitter away from them, basically their little toy, and use it in a way that they don't want and they don't like, I found the panic that ensued at the mere prospect that he would do that so illuminating about how it is that their attempt to control the flow of information and use it to propagandize, because they had to kind of come out and drop the mask and say, no, we can't allow free speech online. It's too important to us that we maintain this censorship regime.
Yeah, it's really interesting how those contradictions come to play. I remember in your Roe v. Wade article, one of the key points in there that really struck me was the idea that being in favor of the Supreme Court holding up Roe v. Wade, one would have to admit that your views are somewhat anti-democratic in that sense. And I feel like a lot of these people don't want to admit that their politics and their inclinations involve not being in favor of freedom. It's like, it's so obvious to everyone else. But I guess the subversive credibility that one gets by being in proximity to like the aesthetics of rebellion or the aesthetics of freedom is really what it's all about. Because when you sort of peel back the layers, they're pretty authoritarian. COVID revealed that. So many things have revealed that. Like you said, January 6th revealed that, all of the stuff that happened after that. And I guess my personal trajectory was I sort of started like in the kind of like, I guess, DSA left sort of trajectory, where the sort of Bernie left trajectory. But as these different events started to unfold, I started to kind of move further and further away from that, because I could no longer justify being socially coerced into being in favor of things that went totally against my principles. But what do you think sparked this change in the left? A lot of people say that it was Trump, that Trump was the sort of thing that caused the derangement. He was the catalyst. But I think it was building up a lot before that. What are your thoughts in terms of why the left is sort of taking this sharp turn towards authoritarianism?
I think whenever a movement persuades itself that it represents some kind of transcendent and universal moral good, that it becomes much more prone to embrace authoritarian tactics in pursuit of that agenda, because they become convinced that they themselves and their political views are so righteous that it's almost inherently impossible for them to do anything abusive or improper, because they're so kind of enlightened and so elevated, as evidenced by their political ideology and the righteousness of it, that you can kind of trust them to wield any kind of power in their hands, because they're such good people that they will obviously wield it for benevolent ends. And once you persuade yourself of that, that hubris and that arrogance that sets in becomes extremely dangerous. You know, I saw that very vividly for the first time when, you know, I began writing about politics in 2005, and I was able to build up an audience quickly because I was being very vocal about the abuses undertaken in the name of the war on terror and some of these broad theories of executive power that George Bush and Dick Cheney were claiming in its name. And Democrats and liberals were highly supportive of the work that I was doing, were applauding it every time I was warning that authoritarianism was increasing and civil liberties were being assaulted in the name of the war on terror. Liberals were very, you know, enthusiastic. And starting around January 20th, 2009, when Barack Obama was inaugurated, after having campaigned on various pledges to reverse those policies, but instead not only embraced them and defended them and continued them, but in many cases escalated them, expanded them beyond where they were, I watched so many Democrats and liberals switch on a dime and decide that, well, actually these policies were no longer bad, because now they were no longer in the hands of a right-wing evangelical fascist, but were in the hands instead of a left-wing progressive enlightened constitutional law professor who could be trusted to wield those same powers. They were only bad when in the hands of people who couldn't be trusted. And a movement that is premised in a conviction about its own, you know, unchallengeable goodness is one that is very prone to turning to authoritarianism, because they begin to think that anything is justified when it comes to the need to win. I think you saw that a lot in the Obama years. As left-wing politics became less about class issues and kind of overturning some of the rough inequities of extreme capitalism and neoliberalism, because that's too hard of a war to fight, and especially once they began forgetting about militarism and imperialism and the CIA. You know, when's the last time you heard people on the left, except in passing, about the CIA? They've, you know, totally forgotten about them, except that they consider them an ally now, and really began focusing almost entirely on culture war issues. You know, we're fighting racism and white nationalism and white supremacy and misogyny and homophobia. You know, that's the kind of talk that convinces you that there's only one side to the debate, and that's the side that you're on. And that even more fuels the kind of fanaticism and blindness that leads you to believe that, you know, of course you should censor anyone who doesn't see the world the way you do, because the way you see the world is the definition of justice. But I think you're right in both senses, that it was already growing and festering, this authoritarian mindset on the left prior to Trump. But Trump really was the accelerant, because this is when liberals and the left ceased being separate factions, at least in this regard, and really began kind of agreeing, almost by definition, that anyone center left or left or anything in that general realm took on as their overarching worldview that the greatest menace to the world and to the United States was Donald Trump and the Trump movement, and that he wasn't just someone who had a bad ideology, who was a conservative, and, you know, all the destructive impacts that that entails, but he was actually a white nationalist dictator. He was a fascist bent on overthrowing American democracy. And if you actually believe that Trump is like a Hitler-like figure, which they absolutely believe, then it's not just justifiable, but almost necessary to resort to any tactic that lets you in. Like, what is censoring people or, you know, finding them guilty with no due process when it comes to the battle to save America from white nationalist dictatorship? I mean, of course, anything is justifiable in the name of doing that if you convince yourself that that's really what your politics are about. And I think they became convinced of that, and in turn became convinced that there should be no limits on their power.
Yeah.
I kind of see so many parallels with the whole Bernie and Jeremy Corbyn situation, even in their downfall as well. And I feel like people that had like a surface level understanding of politics got really mad at either Donald Trump or Boris Johnson. And then anyone that actually understood what happened just before their eyes were actually really mad at the Labour Party or the Democratic Party for completely fucking snaking the only candidates that, like, you know, a whole generation were actually like completely behind and put on the map and like everything else.
But even, even then, beyond that, all the aftermath of the last election as well, like there was that New York Times piece that was print. I think it was the New York Times that was printed, where they basically admitted that there was
all the meddling.
Yeah, there was a collusion between the way that it was worded was that a collusion between left wing activists and big tech and corporate power in order to work to unseat Trump. And like you said, that's like the academic definition of fascism at play right there, in order to quote unquote save democracy. And it was like this sort of open, it was like OJ Simpson's book, like If I Did It or whatever. It was like an almost like an open admission of guilt. And then not too long ago as well, during the mass shootings, the unfortunate series of mass shootings that happened, the one that was committed by a white supremacist that happened in Buffalo, there was another article that came out, and the headline was, the shooter is not just a lone wolf, they're an average Republican. So the acceleration, as they're calling everything everyone else is saying disinformation, as they're accusing people of stirring up violent rhetoric that causes violence to break out in chaos, they're ramping up their rhetoric. There was even an article a few months ago called We Can Replace Them, which was written obviously by a liberal journalist, but they were sort of giving credence to the replacement theory rhetoric that they accuse others of using to stir up hatred and injustice. And it almost seems as if they're more eager for fascism to be a thing than anyone else is. I feel like everyone else is chilling and they're just like chomping at the bit for this like specter to materialize. What do you think about this? What are your thoughts on this whole thing?
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, if you're engaged in politics and you're just kind of having banal fights about what Barack Obama used to call two parties playing within the 40-yard lines, meaning, you know, they have basic fundamental agreement on most things. They occasionally have policy differences about the tax code and, you know, kind of not necessarily trivial, but, you know, not world historic fights over, you know, some disputes. But as he said, they kind of share the same worldview. Politics is kind of unexciting. But if you convince yourself that, you know, fascism is on the front door and you're going to get to be like the greatest generation, the people who stormed the beaches of Normandy and, you know, all those iconic and heroic acts that they undertook to save the West from German fascism, that's exciting. Like, that gives you purpose. And of course, there's some psychological craving especially when the things that give our lives purpose are all being taken away one after the next in terms of religion and our connection to community, and obviously COVID isolating us even further than we were before through behind seeing the world only from our apartments or our homes through a computer screen, makes people crave that, you know, the things that they need, and they turn to politics to get them because they have nowhere else to get them. And that creates this kind of maximalist hysteria, because the stakes need to be very high on everything in order for it to give you the importance and purpose that people otherwise are deprived of. I think, you know, the point about Bernie and Corbyn is an important one too, because, you know, a big part of the problems and the pathologies of Western democracies, I do think, lies a lot with the left. You know, if you're basically going to be a movement that stands up and says, and I think this kind of is encapsulated in one person who lives in your country, Owen Jones. He really represents this mentality so perfectly.
Oh, God.
Like, every day you get up and you're like, yeah, I think we can't forget about Keir Starmer's dishonesty. And, you know, you talk about, like, all the ways that he, like, lied in the campaign and screwed over the left, and he has contempt for the left. But, like, at the end of the day, you always insert as your kind of final pledge that even though you say all these things, of course you're going to always go and not just vote for Labor no matter what, but you're going to condemn everyone who even considers doing something other than voting for Labor every single time. You know, of course you're going to be treated like a pathetic non-entity, because that's what you've turned yourself into. Yeah. Who cares if you're criticizing, you know, Keir Starmer and Joe Biden, if at the end of the day you say, like, yeah, I know that you just spent the last 5 years calling the British left anti-Semites and destroying Jeremy Corbyn's reputation with the worst faith imaginable.
Yep.
And making very clear that you would rather have lost to Theresa May or Boris Johnson than one with Bernie Sanders, with Jeremy Corbyn, even though you've reserved the right for yourself to not vote for Labor if Labor was run by a person you don't like, we're going to obey you when you turn around and tell us, we don't care how much we spit in your face, we don't care how much we humiliate you, we don't care how much we call you racist and anti-Semites and bigots, we don't care if we tell you we're not going to vote for Labor if we don't get what we want. You're not allowed to do that. And then to watch all these people on the left, like Owen Jones, have that mentality of saying, like, oh, no, of course, you can trust us. We're always going to vote for Labor. Don't worry about us. Of course, they're not going to worry about you. Why would they? You've just pledged your unconditional lifelong loyalty to them.
Exactly.
Why would I ever want to, like, appease in any way people who have pledged their lifelong loyalty to me? In fact, I would use those people to gain the votes and support and trust of people who are saying I may not vote for you, by, like, spinning on those people and showing how much I hate them and how much contempt I have for them, by saying, oh, they're anti-Semites and that's totally unacceptable, and by kicking their allies out of the party. And, you know, I see something very similar here in Brazil. Like, this again is part of what's alarming to me, is I'm seeing other parts of the world, which always had a very different politics, start to copy Western political culture, where here in Brazil, you know, there was always a tradition that there were multiple candidates in the first round of voting. You know, the presidential system in Brazil is similar to France's, where you have multiple candidates, the two top candidates, if one doesn't get 50%, go to the second round, like Macron and Marine Le Pen just did, and the winner wins. So that's the system in Brazil, and that frees people to vote for the person that you actually like. So the left votes for the really left-wing candidates, like the center-left votes for Lula and PT, the far-right votes for Bolsonaro, the center-right votes for... But now this framework has arisen where there are only supposed to be two choices, Bolsonaro and Lula, like, kind of turning it into Republicans versus Democrats. And the sense is, if you don't vote for Lula, if you even think about voting for kind of like a Jill Stein, to keep that analogy running, you are now basically an enabler of fascism. This is, you know, the sort of thing that the left is doing, is they're making themselves completely powerless because they're falling for the propaganda and the pressure tactics of neoliberals. I mean, Lula actually selected as his vice presidential running mate this center-left candidate that had long been the villain for You know, it's kind of like the way the left has rehabilitated George Bush and Dick Cheney and neocons, because as long as they're against Trump, then they're our ally. They, you know, they let Lula select this kind of center-right austerity promoting servant of the banking class who they spent the last 20 years calling racist and fascist. And now they're welcoming with open arms and demanding that you do too. And if you point out that, well, he's kind of a scumbag, as they've been saying for the last 20 years, it now means you're an enabler of fascism. Like, the left is so intent upon kind of turning itself into humiliated and weak and powerless servants of the neoliberal ruling order that in many ways they've become their best asset, even as they kind of kick and stream on their podcasts and use curse words to describe them. So on some level, if you are kind of disillusioned with the neoliberal ruling order, maybe 5 years ago you would have looked for the left and said, oh, well, I kind of think maybe Jeremy Corbyn or Bernie Sanders or other kind of movements are the answer. And now the real anti-establishment politics is unfortunately only found on the populist right. Because the left has basically renounced its willingness to do that kind of politics.
Yeah. And whether or not the sentiments that are being expressed on the populist left are like really genuine, we're still yet to see. But you're 100% right in saying that those are the only places where those sentiments are being expressed and upheld. Like you said a couple of weeks ago, it was Donald Trump Jr. saying, like, why are we sending $40 billion to Ukraine when there's no milk on the shelves for babies? That's something that you would have expected to hear out of the mouth of someone like a Bernie Sanders, but
or
he
like
was
an AOC
busy, or yeah, any yeah, of the squad.
All of them voted yes, and then went back to their quiet to, about
yeah.
it.
And there, you could say this about a myriad of issues. You could also say the same about a myriad of issues where everybody is sort of lumped into the basket of deplorables if they aren't on board with exactly what the left wants, like with the whole gun control debate, for instance. Anybody who isn't, you know, saying vote for the Democrats next election season, anyone who's not fully in favor of these gun laws is considered, you know, responsible for dead children. And it just keeps on escalating, keeps the sort of moral culpability that they attempt to wrongly place on people. It keeps on escalating. It really keeps on escalating. And it's quite a depressing and like demoralizing thing if you aren't like okay with being viewed as a bad person. I've developed calluses now because I've been doing this for so long, and I'm sure as have you. But it took a really long time because it also took like me feeling like sometimes, oh, maybe I am a bad person, or second guessing myself, or being like, maybe there is something wrong with me. And it's not natural to have those calluses that we have, but unfortunately you kind of have to develop them because you never know when your own capacity for empathy is like being weaponized against you when you're attempting to navigate this political terrain. How have you dealt with that specific issue? How do you navigate with remaining empathetic while also remaining detached enough not to get sucked in by the bullshit?
I mean, I think you have to first and foremost know yourself and kind of constantly engage in honest self-evaluation about what it is you're doing and why. And, you know, for me, politics was never something that I was consumed with doing as like some kind of lifelong career or cause. In fact, you know, there was a good chunk of my adult life when I actually didn't pay much attention to politics because it didn't seem very significant to me. And I began paying attention, you know, kind of in the wake of 9/11, when I felt like the political culture and landscape had begun to change fundamentally and radically in ways I found quite disturbing. And I wanted to have a voice in explaining why, because I didn't feel like it was being very well represented. And so from the beginning, I kind of engaged with politics and journalism, not as a job. In fact, I didn't, you know, go get a job at the New York Times or, you know, some major newspaper. I just kind of started a blog for free one day and began writing just from like passion in my heart about saying the things I wanted to say. And I have always tried to make sure that that remains my touchstone, that when I think about politics, that the only thing that guides me are the values and causes I believe in, and then I do whatever is needed to find vehicles to advance those causes so that I'm always authentic in what I'm saying and staying true to my core beliefs. And that means, you know, if there's politics that can be done on the left or adjacent to the Democratic Party, then I will go there and do that. And when there's not that space any longer, I'm not going to stay there because I'm somehow forever permanently defined by some, you know, unyielding and unconditional loyalty to the Democratic Party or even the political left. I'm going to go to some other space where it's not where it is being done if it's not there. And so obviously when that means that sometimes you go to the populist right and people start calling you names because you've done that, the only real defense to letting that get to you, or even or worse, to letting it deter you from doing that, is to be assured within your own kind of existence, in your own brain, in your own soul, about what it is that you're really doing, so that when people start to make accusations about your motives or who you are or what you believe in secret, you know that it's untrue and therefore it can't possibly affect you. Maybe you can feel like it's unfair because you're being accused of things or characterized in a way that's untrue. But as long as you know deep down that your real motives are not those, that your real beliefs are not the ones being ascribed to you in bad faith, then it doesn't mean it's fun, but you can kind of brush off those criticisms precisely because they're untrue and continue to pursue the path that you believe is the best one. And ultimately, I do think people can sense intuitively who's authentic and who isn't. You know, some people who aren't authentic can kind of deceive others into believing that they are. Those are, you know, that's kind of like the hallmark of politicians and con artists. I think Barack Obama was good at that. I think Bill Clinton was good at that. I think Donald Trump was good at that. Those are like, you know, the best politicians can do that. But in general, I think people are able to sniff out who's lying to them and who's being truthful. And as long as you keep that authenticity and passion in your voice, I think most people will perceive it.
True that. And yeah, you're definitely a huge example of that as well, and someone that inspires the rest of us lobies. But thank you. One last question before we round out for the night. So the next election cycle is obviously coming up soon, and there's a lot of energy that's sort of being generated around that. I tend to avoid the electoral discourse because it like frightens me and gives me a headache, and everyone gets like really horrible and like brittle during the period. Traumatized from last time, there isn't enough chamomile tea in the universe to like help me get through this next one. But I was wondering what your thoughts are for this upcoming time. People are sort of speculating about a backlash towards a lot of the sort of institutional domination of the left. It seems as if a lot of bridges have been burned. Do you feel this cultural push? Do you have any sort of predictions for what may occur?
Yeah, you know, I agree with your general perspective. For me, as somebody who writes about politics and therefore has to pay attention to it, elections are probably the least interesting and least enjoyable part of the cycle, the political cycle, to me, because they do tend to be very much about manipulation and deceit and propaganda. They're often a kind of byproduct of just events beyond anyone's control, more so than anything that's real. So, you know, in general, the party that's out of power in the White House does well in the midterms. When the economy is struggling, it gets blamed on the president and therefore his party, which also reflects the results of the midterms. There's been lots of political trends that favor the Republicans. Biden is extremely unpopular. That further helps the Republicans. So I think a lot of it is just kind of the ebbs and flows of the political cycle. But I also for sure agree that Democrats have made themselves uniquely unappealing and oftentimes affirmatively grotesque and alienating, in part because they are tied to a political ideology that their funders demand and that they therefore can't escape, but that most people recognize as their enemy, which is the policies of corporatism and militarism and neoliberalism. And then on the cultural front, they have allowed these kind of completely insulated voices to define and shape what the Democratic Party is required to do on cultural issues in a way that is just so far removed from the lives of most people that when they talk about it, most people just either get angry that they're talking about something that seems insignificant, or worse, they're offending people. You know, and I think like the use of this term Latinx is often used. It's a very trivial example, but it really, you know, illustrates that there's a term that comes from academia. It's designed to change the Spanish language on the grounds that something completely inherent to it in so many other Latin languages, namely gendered language, is somehow offensive in this new age where gender is to be recognized as a fabricated concept, and therefore they're demanding not only change these people's language that has existed for thousands of years, but also what they're called, and applying to them this term that none of them even know, let alone want or use themselves. And the only reason why it's interesting and worthwhile to bring that up is because this is the breach between liberal elite culture, especially on cultural issues, and the entire rest of the population that is totally alienated from it, that they have forced upon the Democratic Party, because the Democratic Party, like they need corporate donors and militaristic donors, also need cultural activists as part of their base. And so they're kind of imprisoned and captive to their demands. So you have these Democratic politicians running around talking about Latinx and all kinds of trans issues in a way that the population just isn't ready for. And that just further feeds into the already pre-existing perception, because of the economics and foreign policy of Democrats, that Democrats appease a very small sliver of elite culture at the expense of everybody else. And I think that's certainly at least a part of why they're likely to get slaughtered in November.
Yeah, definitely. And I sort of am observing the same thing. But again, I'm pretty sure they'll find other boogeymen to blame if that's the case.
Some of them will blame the left. Yeah. For, you know, the way they did with Corbyn, the way Labour is still doing with Corbyn. They'll blame Russia, they'll blame Americans for being racist, too racist to vote for them, even though, like, they're led by Joe Biden. So, it'll be all that.
Yeah, and I just see it escalating and escalating and escalating. I think a loss would make them escalate even more than a win would. I'm not looking forward to that whole process. But again, thank you so much. We don't want to keep you for too long or anything, but thank you so much again for coming and talking to us this afternoon. We really, really appreciate it. And would you like to tell people where they can find you and plug all the stuff so that people know?
Yeah, people can read my articles, and if they don't want to do that, they can listen to the audio version of them, which is voiced by the very eloquent Angie. So I really appreciate the work you've been doing with us. It's a big hit among a lot of people.
Thank you.
I use Twitter as my primary social media, and Rumble and Call In as other platforms for video and podcasts. So yeah, I'm around in lots of places.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And we shall catch you later. Goodbye.
Yeah, thank you guys for the invitation. Bye. It was great talking to you. Bye.